My guest today, Susan Lindauer, a former senator's aide who went from opposing the first Gulf War to becoming a paid U.S. government asset. In his efforts to prevent the attack on the World Trade Center on 9/11 and to stop the war in Iraq led to her spending a year in federal prison, charged with being an agent for the Iraqi government. She was one of the first victims of the U.S. Patriot Act and has described her extraordinary story, an ordeal at the hands of our government, together with confirming documents and copious footnotes in a book she has self-published entitled Extreme Prejudice, that at the moment is only available on Amazon. Welcome, Susan Lindauer, to Takes on the World.
I am delighted to be on your show. This is a lot of fun. There's so much happening in the Middle East. Wow.
Wow is right. And we're going to get into that. You know, I have heard and I've read a lot of remarkable and strange and unbelievable stories of my time. But in the field of international politics, I'm not yet finished your book, but I must admit I've never encountered anything approaching yours. In a word, it's Kafkaesque, and you have it all documented. How did someone who protested the first Gulf War in Iraq end up becoming a U.S. government asset dealing with the embassies of Libya and Iraq?
I was a U.S. intelligence asset. Because of my anti-war activism and my anti-sanctions activism, the U.S. government asked me, the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency requested that I consider approaching Libya and Iraq to set up a back channel for information on terrorism. There is a surprising revelation in my book that I had also warned about the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, and that astonishes people because my case in my work in anti-terrorism is like a Greek tragedy. It begins and ends with 9/11, with the World Trade Center. Sorry, with the World Trade Center.
Well, evidently, they approached you because the government was watching anti-war protesters, monitoring anti-war protesters, and they saw something. And you, at that time, you weren't working in Congress, were you, or were you?
I was already working in Congress, but I had a deep passion against the sanctions, the United Nations sanctions on Iraq, particularly the Iraqi sanctions. It was already evident, were causing genocide. 500,000 children died by 1996, and education was wiped out, medical care was wiped out, transportation, clean water, electricity, everything was gone. And so I hated those sanctions, and I wanted to do something about it. And the United States government, to its credit, the CIA, I won't say the United States government, I'll say the CIA, to its credit, at its best, the CIA is very proactive and creative in formulating alliances. They'd rather have you working where they can, you know, have impact and try to interfere in a way with what you're doing than to have you out on your own. And so they gave me this opportunity, but it was an opportunity that was very direct and upfront. I was not manipulated or coerced. They said, you know, if you will approach the embassy in Iraq and approach the Libyan embassy, you can try to make a difference, and perhaps you can persuade these people to cooperate on anti-terrorism. And in the case of Lockerbie, I was engaged in the Lockerbie negotiations for the Lockerbie trial, and so they were like, you know, you can actually play a role in trying to solve the problems that are giving rise to the sanctions.
Well, it's interesting. You have a couple of interesting, very interesting characters in the book. One, a Dr. Richard Fuss, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, but he has a kind of a Central European background, who is a remarkable character doing so many things, and he seemed to have firsthand knowledge of Lockerbie and was not allowed to testify about it, that initially everything the finger pointed to Syria, but then the United States wanted to get cozy with Syria and they switched it to, more conveniently, to Libya, and it was kind of a case that aroused suspicion, or the change of target aroused suspicion, not only, well, somewhat in this country, more in Europe and actually in Europe and in England.
Yes, indeed. And Richard Fuse told me from our very first meeting. Now let me give you his background. He was based in Beirut and Syria during the 1980s, and he was leasing oil equipment to the Syrian oil industry, and he was involved in the hostage rescue of Terry Anderson. He was one of the, as he puts it, he is the one who called in the Delta Force after the CIA, his team at CIA, identified the Coven of Allies in Beirut where the hostages were being held. And this was these people were being brutalized. They were chained, you know, for literally chained to the floor for like 3 or 4 years. This had gone on. This was a nightmare situation where these people were trapped in buildings that were being bombed in the Beirut Civil War, and it was just a horrifying situation for these people. And Richard was involved in rescuing them, and so his knowledge of Lockerbie goes to that, his physical presence on the ground in Beirut. And what he has said was that the CIA, in trying to identify where the hostages were being held, was engaged with some very dirty people who were involved in heroin trafficking out of the Baqa. And the terrorists were using heroin trafficking out of the Baqa Valley in Lebanon to finance their terrorism operations. And so the CIA was turning a blind eye to that, while the Defense Intelligence Agency got very angry and wanted to stop it and said, we shouldn't be supporting heroin trafficking. You cannot condone this kind of behavior, even if you're going to rescue these hostages. So it would be a great movie if anybody would really cover the story the way it really happened.
And the plane that Lockerbie plane carried a whole group of these DIA agents went down over Lockerbie.
It carried 3 Defense Intelligence agents and 3 CIA agents who were all returning to Washington, D.C. on the same plane to report to Washington and to complain and defend themselves in an inquiry.
Now, it's interesting that in other situations we saw in Vietnam War and in Central America that when it was useful for U.S. policy to support drug production, the U.S. supported it. With the Golden Triangle in Laos and Vietnam, the U.S. supported it as they did in Central America to finance the Contras. So it's interesting. But in the Baca Valley, it was not being used for U.S. purposes. So I guess that was one of the reasons they were ready to go against it.
Yes. It's exactly. And the people, and again, the heroin trafficking is the global currency of terrorism. I think I've heard somewhere that 90% of the opium in global heroin production comes from Afghanistan, but it may be closer to 80%, and then another 15% comes from the Baqa Valley. Okay, those are the 2 major producers of opium in the world community, and they're controlled by terrorists.
Well,
okay, when they talk about the Colombian drug cartels being tied to the Middle East, that's why. Okay, it's actually a very serious problem, and Americans, by refusing to understand this Lockerbie case, are actually missing the point, which is that we have, you know, of this relationship. It's like we're deliberately blind to this connection.
Well, of course, the U.S. has used the Colombian drug cartel as an excuse to establish military bases in Colombia. And so it's like the NARCs and the DEA, for example, it's like the prison industry, the drug control industry. It's kind of a game. The more prisoners there are, the more prisons we built, the more drugs are a problem, the bigger budget for the drug enforcement agencies. I want to shift to Iraq, though, because one of the interesting things. In your book is how Iraq and Saddam Hussein wanted to become back into the embrace of Washington, which he once enjoyed. I mean, we had Bob Dole and Dick Rumsfeld and Rob Rumsfeld visiting him, and we were providing him with all kinds of weaponry, including chemical weapons, and that's a matter of record. And Saddam actually believed he was a U.S. ally. I mean, and then he really wanted to get back in, and after 9/11, he wanted to give information about the al-Qaeda network to Washington, but you write in your book that Washington wanted to go to war. At least Bush administration didn't want to hear from Iraq. They wanted to go to war. Perhaps you tell us about that.
That's right. That's right. Saddam Hussein was the FBI of the Middle East. He tracked Islamic fundamentalists mercilessly. He was obsessively convinced that Islamic jihadis would become terrorists and would take advantage of the United Nations sanctions and the breakdown in security in order to try to set up base in Iraq. So he was merciless in hunting them out of his society and throwing them out of his society. And he was perhaps one of our very best sources of anti-terrorism intelligence throughout the 1990s, during the whole period of animosity between the United States and Iraq, and the whole time of the sanctions. Saddam always recognized that anti-terrorism was his strongest suit, and in this he was very much like Dick Cheney. You might not have liked Saddam Hussein, but not for the reasons that you have said, that the world has tried to say that he was, you know, he was in with the terrorists, because he was very much afraid of the terrorists, and
more of fundamentalism, but he was secular.
He was secular, but from the start of the Bush administration, we had begun negotiating a comprehensive peace framework. Saddam Hussein's government deeply wanted to rejoin the West, and they were willing to give the United States everything that we asked for, including the following: weapons inspections, which of course proved that there would be no weapons. But Iraq was always very enthusiastic to get started on the weapons inspections, because they knew that they would come up empty-handed. So they were never reluctant. The United States was the one that refused to go into Baghdad and was pulling back. The other thing that Iraq offered was cooperation with terrorism. They were, before 9/11, they were willing to let the FBI come into Baghdad and operate a task force with authority to conduct terrorist investigations, to make interview witnesses, and to make arrests.
And this is this is all information, of course, you got from your dealings with the Iraqi embassy in Washington.
In New York. And after 9/11, they offered financial records on al-Qaeda. And they were like, this is hot stuff. The financial records on al-Qaeda would have allowed the United States to shut down the financial pipeline on al-Qaeda without going to war in Afghanistan or Iraq. You didn't have to fire a shot. You could have surgically cut them off from their financing, and that would have crippled their operations, okay, in a way that you've never been able to do by going to war. All of this is in my book, Extreme Prejudice, and I urge you that we're just hitting the top of this. There's a lot of depth here.
Well, you're saying that in your book, and you're implying that the Bush administration and people in the decided they didn't want to hear any warnings about a possible attack on 9/11. They, in fact, anticipated in advance and were ready to use it as an excuse to go to war in Iraq.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. And I was ordered, it's very difficult for people to hear this. I've been amazed at how the American public has resisted the truth. We absolutely expected 9/11 to occur, and it's just time to stop pretending otherwise. And I was personally ordered, by my CIA handler to threaten Iraq with war if the 9/11 attack occurred. And I was this message was communicated by me to the Iraqis at the instruction of my CIA handler in April and May of 2001, all the way through the summer, right up until my last meeting, I can tell you the date, was August 4th, 2001, and that was my meeting at the Iraqi embassy. And after that, my CIA handler told me, do not go to New York because the attack is imminent. We are expecting mass casualties, and we expect the use of a miniature thermonuclear device. Okay, so this was identified, and he said, do not go back to New York until after the attack.
That's interesting. He also, according to your book, he wasn't happy that you weren't strong enough with your warnings to the Iraqis. And
Yes.
Now, what happened...
But then he demanded that I go back. That was the first time in April of 2001. My immediate reaction when I was told of this threat was to be very polite, and of course that's ordinarily what you do is you go in and you say, hey, we're looking for, we understand there's a conspiracy and we'd like to get information if you have anything, and you're very polite about it because you're dealing with a sovereign country. And I went back and Richard said, well, what did the Iraqis say? And I said, they've promised they're going to give it, they're going to send the cable to Baghdad, and I'm sure if they know of anything, they'll send it back to us. And he said, I didn't tell you to be polite to those SOBs. I told you to, shove it hard, He was very, very angry, and he demanded that I had to go back and threaten them from the highest levels of government. I had to make sure that they understood this was not a low-level threat. This was above the CIA director and above the Secretary of State. And okay. He wanted me to say that to them.
So that's
what I said to them.
Well, so okay, now we've had the war, and there's going to be an investigation of what the fall of the intelligence was. And you went to Trent Lott and John McCain, and you wanted to testify at this investigation about the information that you had that could have prevented the war that the American public hadn't heard. And 1 month later, you were arrested as an Iraqi agent.
Yes, on the Patriot Act, yes.
And then when you came to trial, you were...
There was no trial. No, I was never allowed to have a trial.
And were judged to be incompetent by... but you weren't allowed to testify. Tell us about that.
This was an extraordinary, Kafkaesque is the word. It was the most frightening thing that you could have imagined. First of all, we had done a great job on Iraqi pre-war intelligence. I was accused formally of telling Congress and the White House that the war would be catastrophic. And I had outlined, I was accused of saying that the war would cost $1.6 trillion, that Iran would emerge as a regional power, that democracy would throw power away from the moderate Arab governments to fundamentalists. I was doing, and that terrorists would establish a base inside Iraq and would take advantage of the chaos. To brutalize American soldiers. Okay, everything I said was true and accurate, but that was not the message that the White House wanted to communicate. They wanted to say that we had failed and that assets were incompetent. So in this very surreal situation, I get dragged into court as an accused Iraqi agent, which is just silliness because I'd been an asset supervised by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Everything I had done was debriefed. I had received instructions. The projects that I was working for were for the United States' advantage, not for the Iraqis. There was just no question. And yet they hauled me into court, and they declared me incompetent to stand trial on the basis that I was so convinced of my innocence, quote, that I did not appreciate the gravity of the charges against me. And therefore, because I was so convinced of my innocence and I was so convinced of my inevitable acquittal, I should not be allowed to have a trial at all, and I should be sentenced to prison. The quote, my desire to pursue witnesses and leads resulted in a mental defect.
And
you believe it. It's scary, scary, scary. And I was never allowed to have a hearing. They just rubber stamped me and said, she's incompetent, send her to prison. and I was sent to prison on a Texas military base, Carswell Air Force Base, outside of Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas.
The medical facility there.
It is a prison.
Yes.
It is a prison. They call it, technically the name is Carswell Federal Medical Center. However, it is not a hospital like you would think of. It is not a mental institution. It is a prison, and they treat HIV, hepatitis, cancer, heart disease. And so they have some facilities if you have medical conditions, which means that they're authorized to give drugs, essentially. But there's no, you don't get CAT scans there, you don't get an MRI there, you don't get, you're a prisoner, so you're not entitled to surgery on the federal dollar. You know, they're not going to give you anything like that. You don't get chemotherapy at Carswell.
Well, a friend of mine there is a wing at Carswell where they do give it, but it's a friend of mine who was down there and had chemo and recently died after she was released from there. But the idea that you were not allowed to testify because you were declared to be incompetent, usually it's the lawyers for
well,
the
well,
witness
let me,
who...
Let yeah. me, sorry, let yeah. me just cut you off. Let me just yeah. interrupt you and give you a correction
yeah.
on your friend,
yeah.
who because you said she's died. Actually, Carswell is notorious for withholding chemotherapy until the very last stages when you're minutes from death, then they may give you something. But there are stories of women with like heart conditions or women with who've had surgery before they come into the prison who have collapsed on the floor and the staff just step right over them.
You know, they don't even
pick them up off the floor. If you have like some kind of seizure or anything like that, and or a heart attack, they just walk right over you.
I've heard it's a pretty horrible place, and they have special visiting rules there that are strictly for Carswell do not apply. They don't accept the rules for visitors for other federal prisons. You have to go specially through them. It's a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
In any way, getting back to this case, you provide so much information. The way the government works in this book, that particularly I've maintained that the war, I'm one of those who've maintained that the reason we went to war in Iraq was because this was a plot, not a plot, a part of a plan of the neocons who had particularly Richard Perl, and Douglas Feith and Wormser, who had tried to get advise the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to go after Hussein in 1996, and they came into the Bush government. Then we had the
yes.
Project for a New American Century, in which they called primarily for getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, this war was insane. You predicted, like
yes.
other people did before it happened, what was going to be the result for the United States in the region.
This was a war for Israel. This was definitely a war for to benefit Israel. It had no possible benefit for the United States. Iraq was offering the United States preferential contracts in telecommunications, healthcare, hospital equipment, and pharmaceuticals. Transportation, Iraq offered to buy 1 million American-made automobiles every year for 10 years. And above all, Iraq offered the United States massive oil contracts. The United States never had to go to war to get oil from Iraq. Iraq would have handed it to the United States. They wanted to give the United States the oil. They wanted to give it to them. And it was just like the weapons inspections. Everybody was told that Iraq had been resisting the weapons inspections. On the contrary, from the end of the Clinton administration, Iraq had been quite anxious to get the weapons inspectors back in as fast as possible because they recognized that was necessary to ending the sanctions, and so they were saying, please, you know, come on in. They said that when Colin Powell made his speech, his famous speech on Capitol Hill at the start of his term, that the conversations on weapons inspections would be short. It would be a short conversation. He was actually paraphrasing what the ambassador from Iraq had said, which was that, the Iraqis were so excited to begin the weapons inspections that it would only take about 2 to 3 weeks of talks, and they would let you in immediately. It would be a very short discussion because Iraq was committed already to the goal. Iraq had already agreed.
Now, it's interesting, we see what's happened to Iraq's oil subsequent to the war, and that all the major contracts have gone to China, to Malaysia, to other countries, and U.S. oil companies have the smallest take of the Iraq oil and of the Iraq's oil wealth, which could have been, obviously Iraq had to sell it somewhere. The notion that this was a war for oil was sold to the the government didn't say that, but people secretly knew it, but that's what it was all about. And unfortunately, the anti-war movement bought into that and said no blood for oil, but in fact, it was not a blood. It was no blood in a sense for Israel in that sense.
I agree with you, and let me tell you, you make a very interesting point, which is that a lot of these contracts did end up going to other countries, and that is the greatest irony of all is the United States. In order to get the coalition of the willing, quote-unquote, the United States had to trade some of its oil that would have come to us. We would have had the without war, in a no-war situation, Iraq was willing to give us the majority of oil contracts in Iraq from now until the end of time. Okay, right before the invasion, Iraq took a contract from Lukoil, which was a Russian company,
yes.
and they offered to give the Lukoil contract to the United States. And so the United States actually has come out with less oil now than they would have had without a war. And the oil infrastructure in Iraq has been so badly damaged, the pumping stations, the pipelines, there's sabotage. The Iraqis hate that the United States is obviously there, and so they're sabotaging anything that would give profit to the invaders. And so the Iraqi oil infrastructure is so crippled at this point that we are in a deficit situation with regards to oil for war. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Actually, I'm going to open the phones here for to our listeners. 895-2448 is the number. If you have any questions or comments on what my guest Susan Lindauer, whose new book, Extreme Prejudice. She had to self-publish it, obviously. This is very hot stuff, and I don't think most publishers would take a risk on it.
It's all heavily documented.
And that is
key. It's heavily documented, but it challenges everything you were told, and it shatters the lies. So all of your presumptions, whether you're progressive or conservative, everything you were led to believe has been a lie.
I agree with that. I see that we already have the boards lit up. I just want
happy to take.
Yeah,
calls.
I'm going to open the phone. Just 1 second.
Please.
I just want to mention, listeners, that your second cousin was Andrew Card, who is a major player in the Bush administration, and you communicated all this information to him as well as to Colin Powell. And
yes. And the CIA. I had a CIA handler, a defense intelligence handler. My cousin was the chief of staff to George Bush, and Colin Powell, Secretary of State, got everything.
Okay.
So they've all lied to the people.
And here we go with the first caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. I didn't get how to obtain the book, and
Amazon.com.
I want to make the comment that it seems to comply with the information that the FBI, when they were screaming bloody murder, were completely ignored, and that must have been from higher authority.
You mean the 9/11 warnings?
Yes.
In Minneapolis, the FBI in Minneapolis, which was trying to investigate Moussaoui, we had actually, first of all, you can get my book, Extreme Prejudice, on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. It is slowly getting into the bookstores, but right now you do have to get it online. With regards to the FBI, we had asked, in my book, it's revealed that my CIA handler had asked me to contact the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft and the Office of Counterterrorism at the Justice Department to put out an emergency broadcast alert through all agencies, all law enforcement agencies, seeking any fragment of intelligence on airplane hijackings. And that is done in about the 8th or 10th of August. And so right before then, right after that, the FBI begins to try to collect information and tries to hand it back through the emergency broadcast alert that we've put out, which you don't even know existed. That's what we did. There was a demand for it. We demanded it. And so they did it, and so that the FBI was actually responding to the request for the information. So the FBI was vigilant. At the mid-level, people were trying very hard to cooperate. It was the higher-up people who were doing everything they could to thwart compliance. There was no cooperation at the cabinet level. They shut us down. It was a deliberate command negligence, is what I call it in my book.
Very interesting. We're still lit up here. We go to the next caller.
Well,
hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeffrey. I wanted to go back to something that Susan Lendauer said about the Lockerbie crash and pinning this whole thing on the Libyans, despite the fact that many publications in Europe and elsewhere have brought out a lot of evidence to say that the Libyans were not guilty of this at all. I wonder if she truly believes that the Libyans were.
Oh, no, I am one of, thank you, good question, sir. I'm glad to clarify this. I am one of the very few people inside the United States who has been willing to go on record saying that Libya had nothing to do with it. Libya was not involved. There is a new story out just in the past hour that the Libyan justice minister who is fleeing the violence in Libya is trying to say that Gaddafi ordered the Lockerbie attack. That is totally bogus. It is a false flag. I have seen with my own eyes documentation, classified documentation, I must say, from the Defense Intelligence Agency regarding meetings with Arabs, with Syrians and Iranians building up to the Lockerbie attack. And these were in the months before the Lockerbie attack, you know. So there was an advance intelligence, and all these reports were being submitted in to the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they proved that Syria and Iran did it. There's documentation that Syria and Iran did it. But what's interesting is the corporate media has loved to hammer Gaddafi. And so you don't hear anything about that stuff here in the United States. But in Europe, those documents have been circulated. Those documents are in the European media, but in CNN and Fox News, you're not going to hear anything at all.
It was interesting. Gaddafi was only too happy to pay the money.
No, he was not happy. He was really angry about it. They fought about that for years before it went down.
No, but I mean, but. And later on, he bragged that he was able to get all that money that he paid to the Lockerbie families back from the oil companies that came in there.
Yeah, there you go.
We're still lit up here. Let's go over to the next call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I hate to be so cynical, but with all this information and a book published, why hasn't she been assassinated?
That's a really good question. Let me tell you, this is so funny that you asked that question, because my book is called Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Cover-Ups of 9/11, of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. And the word extreme prejudice, that phrase, is the intelligence language for an assassination.
Oh.
So my book is titled Assassination.
I see.
Also, I should say that the mainstream media is giving you no publicity. You don't hear Susan on any other radio stations, or maybe some on-air radio stations, but basically the mainstream media cooperates with the government, so they don't have to assassinate people. They just censor them from the media. But quickly, we have a number of really interesting and good local booksellers. If a bookseller wants to get your book to sell, how do they do that?
It's called Lawson's. There's a bookseller called Lawson's, and they can order it through them.
And it
can be ordered through Amazon.
But I mean, for booksellers to sell the book.
Yes, there's a bookseller called Lawson's.
Lawson.
Yes, yes.
And where are they located?
I will email you that information.
Okay, I'll see that.
I will email that information to you.
Okay, great. And I'll make that available to the listeners.
I appreciate that, because this is a book that should be, that this information shatters everything you were told, and it's a totally different perspective, and it's the real story, and you will see how desperately the government fought to stop you from ever hearing this truth.
It is quite amazing. We have here. I'm going to give another call.
Sure. Caller
on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
I'd like to hear some more about these terrorists in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, the drug-financed terrorism. Can you say more about who that is and
who
they
were
with?
Actually, in the 1980s, they were tied to Hezbollah. Okay, they were the militant arm of the Palestinian movement, and I hate to say that the Palestinians are all militant.
Well, the Lebanese movement, you mean?
Yeah. But the whole Lebanese faction was fighting against Israel, and again, you know, there's regional politics that come into play, and they were supporting the Palestinian cause, but they are. You know, it's Syria and Lebanon, and it is financed by Iran.
And so, to your knowledge, is that drug action still going on? Are those people still active in plotting?
Yes, indeed. It's estimated that the Bekaa Valley produces 15 to 20%
the actual
of
opium
the
production.
Opium and exports for heroin production globally. And that money is connected into the Colombian drug cartels, which then take the raw opium and produce the heroin, which is then distributed throughout the world.
Nice business. Okay, yeah. We're going to give you another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I wonder if your guest has any knowledge of actual cooperation of the U.S. government with the 9/11 attackers, or do they just stand back and let it happen?
Well, that's a very good question. What they did was they it's really a question of whether Israel was involved. And that is something that the government does not want to examine too closely, because Israel is such a great ally of the United States. We know that the CIA had some information. There's a question of deniability. And so my team, my CIA handler, he and I discussed the 9/11 conspiracy from June onwards every single week. It was a major concern. He was extremely agitated about it. My CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, would never, I can tell you, ever have withheld information if he'd been able to get it. And he kept pushing me for any fragment of intelligence that would identify a name, a flight number, a port of call. Like, was it going to happen in Boston, or was it going to happen in Minneapolis?
And right now, Susan, we have come to an end of a very interesting hour. It's now, and so I'm going to have to end.
Read my book for the answer to that question.
Yes. Extreme Prejudice by Susan Lindauer. And I will get information here so bookstores here can get it. So thank you much, Susan, for being our guest today on Takes on the World. Good luck.
I enjoyed it very much. I'd love to come back.
So did I. You will. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.